Greetings. This is Dr. Carol Myers from the University of Tennessee College of Nursing. Welcome to Health Connections, the show about people, health, and policy. There's been a lot of attention recently on what are called adverse childhood experiences, or sometimes referred to as ACEs. We did a show previously on Health Connections on ACEs. Not long after the show, I had an opportunity to share a concern with a colleague. We know ACEs can result in negative physical and mental health. Is this the end of the story? What about the children who have experienced abuse or household challenges such as violence in the home, substance abuse, and mental illness? Is there hope for these children despite what they've experienced? Today, the colleague I mentioned, Dr. Allison Neal, is here to discuss these questions with me. Dr. Neal is a certified psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner and a child and adolescent specialist. Welcome to Health Connections, Dr. Neal.
Thank you, Dr. Myers.
We know ACEs become toxic. Their harmful effects result from stress. I've read that stress associated with ACEs actually causes changes in the brain. Can you talk about that and help me understand that better?
Changes do occur when negative things happen to all of us. And for children, that can be a stressful event, or it can be long-term stress. And so what we'll often see is that there are changes that do occur as a result from this stress.
The fact that the changes occur is significant, but more importantly, what does it mean for that child?
Right. What does it look like? Well, in children, we see problems in education. So for a child, it may be as simple as they're having trouble getting their schoolwork done. It may be that they are more irritable. It may be that they have problems with making connections with other friends. So a lot of times, it looks like that they are having problems learning.
That sounds pretty serious when the work of childhood is learning mm-hmm. and play. Mm-hmm. Can these changes in the brain be reversed? If so, how can this be done?
Carol, I think that's the good news of this. As we talked about before, we know that changes can occur when negative things happen, but changes can also happen when something good occurs. And what we know about children is children are very resilient. And so if we work with them on building that resiliency, then changes will happen in the brain, but these are positive changes, and we can overcome what has happened to our kids.
Okay, so let's dig in a little deeper. What do you mean by resilient?
When we think in general about somebody being resilient is when something bad happens that we're able to overcome that. So there are skills that are called resiliency skills to help improve whatever has happened to children. And it's little things. It's small things that we all can do to help our children be more resilient.
Well, let's talk about those things. I heard two things. There's small things we can do mm-hmm. that perhaps have big impact and that we all can do. So mm-hmm. could you describe those things and talk about how we all can be engaged in helping children who have suffered adverse childhood experiences?
Well, I think one of the best things about resiliency skills is it's taken outside of a mental health facility. You know, we know a lot of people are very uncomfortable with talking about mental health or getting some help for mental health. So resiliency skills are best taught in the community by teachers. I think teachers are really our best asset at this because they're with their children all day long. Parents can be taught these skills to use in their own home. Community centers, boys and girls clubs, places of religion. These are all places that we can use these skills to help our children. And you don't have to have any special education to be able to do this. You just have to be trained in these resiliency skills.
Okay, so could you give me a sense what the training is like or what these skills are that we're going to ask people to learn and then use to help children?
Sure. Some of the easiest things that we can do, and it's really funny when you think about it, is just breathing exercises. If a child has been stressed in any manner, what we know is that the brain tends to run very fast. It's almost like the brain is on a motor, just running, running, running. So we need the brain to pause for just a minute. Breathing exercises are one of the best ways for kids to learn to stay present in the moment and slow down their brain.
What are other skills?
We also work on skills called grounding. And grounding is just being aware of where you are in space and time in that moment. So for kids in a classroom, we work on grounding of paying attention to how your body feels in the seat you're sitting in, or how your feet feel in your shoes. So it makes, once again, the brain pause for just a moment. It slows things down so that the child can be aware of what's going on and be in control of the situation again.
Are there other skills that are characteristic of treating children to, or helping children to be more resilient?
Well, and one of the first things we do is we get kids to pay attention to what's going on inside of them. We call that tracking the nervous system. So if we can get kids to pay attention to what's going on, one of the first things they often notice is their heart is beating very fast, or they're breathing fast, or their stomach is upset. And that's disturbing to children because it feels out of control to them. So if we get them to pay attention to that for just a moment, and they catch that that's happening, then they'll use their resiliency skills. So they've tracked their nervous system, then we use our resiliency skills to bring their nervous system back under their control so that they can make good decisions about what happens next.
So is it this bringing your nervous system under control that helps to rewire the pathways in your brain?
It absolutely is. So for everything bad that has happened in the past, we know that if we use these skills, we can overcome that, and we rewire the brain in a positive way, and it basically just gives the brain some more coping skills.
So it sounds to me as if children oftentimes are coming from a very chaotic and sometimes very harmful environment, and what you're talking about, a piece of it, is helping them not necessarily control the environment, but to control their reaction, what they can have control of, how their body responds to the environment. Am I understanding what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly correct. And kids love this because if they've come from a stressful environment, you're right, they feel really out of control, and this gives them the peace that they can control.
In your work with children, parents, and people in the community, what is the uptake of people, one, accepting they have a role, and then learning and using these resiliency skills?
I think the biggest uptake is that there is hope. Many people, children especially, who have been through difficult situations feel like that is their life. So I want to make sure that they know that anything bad that has happened to them in the past is not their future, that they have control over their future and that there's hope and that they're not defined by the worst moment that ever happened in their life.
So are you getting buy-in from teachers and clergy and other religious leaders and interested people in the community?
We are, because what we see about resiliency skills is that they're easy to learn and anyone can do them, and you can do them in any situation.
Great. I think about the number of children, and we think about 60% of adults carry the stress from childhood into their adulthood, and by then it's harder to rewire the brain. What are the obstacles for resiliency training and having this become common practice so we can offer hope to our children?
Well, and you're right. At first, when anybody's learning about resiliency skills, it does seem too good to be true. But we have evidence now that this, in fact, happens, that changes in the brain happen for the good. The downside of this is there's still a lot of stigma around mental health. People think that there's something wrong with them if they have to seek out mental health care. That's why resiliency, we go from a perspective of not what happened to you or not what's wrong with you, but what's right with you, and we build on what's right.
Okay, so you've talked about stigma, which is a recurring theme when we look at stress and other mental health issues, drug use, et cetera. And you've talked about mental health providers. Do we have enough providers in East Tennessee to treat the children who need treatment?
We don't. We don't have enough mental health providers anywhere. You know, East Tennessee is my home as well. And I practice in a very rural area, and we don't have enough providers there. But it's no different in our cities. We don't have enough mental health providers there either. We need more mental health providers. And since we don't, this is an area that our community can get involved and help kind of bridge this gap that we have.
Well, thank you for that comment, because it illustrates our concern about the intersection between people, health, and policy. Thank you so much for being a guest on Health Connections, Dr. Allison Neal from the University of Tennessee College of Nursing.
Thank you.